Hello and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast with me, Mark Williams. I'm delighted to introduce my guest this week, Rachel Hoyland. Rachel is a shipping lawyer and a senior associate at law firm Hill Dickinson based in the UK. Rachel trained with another firm after qualifying in 2010. She moved to an in-house counsel role at CMA CGM in the great city of Liverpool, my hometown. Rachel joined the shipping team at Hill Dickinson in 2015 and in recent years has taken a particular interest in ESG, decarbonisation and green issues for her clients. She's worked on projects in these fields with the IMO and the UK Department of Transport, for instance. So, Rachel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark.
Delighted to have you on. You're our first lawyer, our first solicitor.
Oh, really? Quite an honour.
Broaching new ground for us. So let's look at things from that legal perspective, if we may. So, you know, from your legal perspective, what would you say are the key issues on the decarbonisation agenda today?
Well, I think the key issue is regulation. What regulation already exists, what regulations are upcoming, and what level of regulation there will be in the future. And we're seeing a really interesting thing in the decarbonisation realm at the moment where the industry is really keen to be regulated so that that can operate to create a level playing field. Because at the moment, there's quite a high degree of uncertainty for operators who are wanting to reduce their carbon emissions. But they're not quite sure what landscape they're trying to align with, what technologies they should deploy, where they should make capital investment. And so we're seeing, and I'm increasingly hearing as I speak to various stakeholders, the industry would like to see more regulation and to be regulated, because whatever that regulation is, it creates clarity and it means that everyone is either suffering the same difficulties or the same problems. You know, it just levels the playing field. Already we've got things like the EEDI regulations and the SEEMP regulations, which are at IMO level, which relate to ship efficiency. There's some updates to that upcoming in 2023, which are the EEXI and CII regulations. But before that, we've actually got some regulation coming in at EU level, which is the inclusion of emissions from shipping in the emissions trading scheme. That's from the 1st of January next year. So there is regulation already, there is regulation upcoming, but the industry is definitely asking for more. So I think that's really a key legal issue in the agenda. And then alongside that, we've got as well the adjustment of various parties' relations on a more voluntary basis, because the industry is not standing back and doing nothing and asking for regulation. It's asking for regulation and taking action at the same time. So there's a lot of moving parts in the picture, and that naturally leads to changes in the way that parties are relating to one another, and that throws up, you know, new legal issues, the need to revise and revisit contracts. So quite a lot going on there, really.
Indeed. And it is an unusual situation, I suppose, in that shipping is asking to be regulated. Normally, shipping does everything it can to hide from regulation and to delay regulation.
I won't comment specifically on that, but it's a curious mode of regulation as well, I think, for the industry, because I think it's often the case that the regulations for shipping in the past have set out both what needs to be achieved and how to achieve it. Whereas we're entering a realm, and we saw this with IMO 2020, although there were in relation to the reduction of sulfur content in fuels, although there were some defined options, we're actually moving into an environment where the regulations set out the goal to be attained, but then leave open the way in which it is to be attained. And I think that's a bit of a new thing for the industry to deal with, to kind of have that freedom of making decisions, which perhaps in some quarters welcome, perhaps in other quarters, you know, people sometimes like to be told what to do. So maybe a mixed reception there as to that shift in emphasis.
Yeah, for sure. Let's zoom in a little bit. You know, you've outlined what you think are the key issues on the decarbonisation agenda. So what about the work that you in particular have been doing? What projects have you been involved with?
So my interest in this area was really sparked by involvement in a couple of projects in 2019. I was involved in a consultation with the Department for Transport on the Clean Maritime Plan. And the Clean Maritime Plan is a, I'm not sure what the right word for it would be, sort of policy document, which is all about creating an environment in the UK specifically where clean maritime can thrive and it's supported. And that's by way of the creation of some incentives and some grassroots funding, etc. So that was an interesting consultation to be involved in because that was really broad. People from all across the industry and people actually a little bit outside shipping as well. So looking at the issue from the perspective of related industries and sectors. And then very hot on the heels of that, I was involved in a project with the International Maritime Organization, the IMO, in a much, much smaller group. So the DFT group was a big group, probably definitely 100 plus. The IMO group was a much smaller group, and we spent a few days trying to work through the issues from different perspectives around the industry in relation to just-in-time arrivals. So we had some representations from ports, some from different sectors of shipping, so bulkers, tankers, containers, etc. I was invited to be there on the basis of giving guidance from a legal perspective as to kind of what was possible to achieve in charter party clauses. And that was just really interesting. Some of the themes that emerged from that were related to information sharing and the whole landscape in which parties engage with one another and with the port, and that being quite siloed, and the need to kind of open that out so that parties had information. And for anyone who doesn't know or isn't familiar with just-in-time arrivals, this is the concept where, so at the moment, what often happens in shipping is a ship will proceed, it's obliged to proceed usually with due dispatch to arrive at the port, which often means that it steams there reasonably swiftly, arrives. It doesn't necessarily have a scheduled berthing slot or a time when it knows it can berth. So it will then wait outside the port, and it can be waiting for hours, days, weeks. So I think days is probably the most usual scenario. So that's sometimes called a rush to wait model. And of course, emissions are directly correlated more or less with fuel consumption. It's not 100% true actually, because there's a kind of optimal point, an optimal speed for reducing emissions. So that correlation doesn't continue indefinitely, but just sort of taking the principle that it's kind of basic level, you know, if vessels are rushing to arrive in port, they're burning more fuel than perhaps they need to, which means they're producing more emissions than perhaps they need to. Whereas if the process of a vessel's incoming voyage to port could be more closely managed with the vessel receiving information from the port as it's incoming about when a berth is going to be available, about when other services it needs to access while it's in port are going to be available, the vessel can adjust its speed from much, much further out from the port so that it is just coming in more steadily, burning less fuel, producing less emissions, and then it arrives at a time very proximate to when a berth is available to it. So it's not rushing and waiting, it's arriving just in time.
It makes absolute sense if you've got access to the ports that aren't dependent on things like tides, which only, you know, sort of happen twice a day. And I suppose then, even then, with the just-in-time model, you can plan your approach so that you arrive on the high tide if you need to, or float out on the high tide if you need to.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, and the improvement on the Russian weight emissions seems quite obvious. What I like about this project, having heard from you, was this barrier about information flow between all the involved parties, because having worked in shipbroking for many years, you know, that we see not ships but information as our stock in trade. And it's the asymmetry of information between the owner who sees their bit of the market and the cargo owners who see all of the market. It's that asymmetry of information that drives the freight market. So sharing information between parties means, to some extent, tearing up historical practice in tramp shipping. So it's interesting to see that climate change is driving a more cooperative freight model.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And actually, BIMCO have produced a kind of model just-in-time arrival clause. And one of the first sort of facets of that is that owners and charterers need to obtain and share information. And overall, there's more of a thrust towards collaboration. As you say, that's absolutely necessary.
So collaboration is one way to help to manage emissions. And another way, I suppose, is to price them, is to make people pay for them. You know, pay as you emit is the model for industry. And that's going to come to shipping. As you mentioned, the EU is going to bring shipping into its into its ambit for the emission trading scheme from next year. So what regulatory developments have you noticed particularly around that?
This is a really interesting one because this is happening pretty soon. The proposal is for emissions from shipping to be caught within the ambit of the EU emissions trading scheme from the 1st of January 2022. And where we're at the moment is the EU Parliament voted last year to approve proposed amendments to legislation that would bring that into effect. But what needs to happen is the EU member states need to discuss and agree that and perhaps negotiate and maybe even amend those proposals. And that process is ongoing. So we don't have a final version of the rules, which in theory will be applicable in, 7 months' time. So it's quite interesting. From what we have seen of the approved draft proposals, the way the scheme mm-hmm. will work is that the EU emissions trading scheme is a cap and trade scheme. So every year the EU sets a cap on the total quantity of emissions that can be produced. And what it does then is it divides that cap into allowances. An allowance is effectively a permit to produce 1 ton of carbon dioxide or its equivalent within a certain time frame. So if you're going to emit carbon dioxide in a way which will fall within the ambit of the scheme, you need to submit an allowance for that carbon dioxide to the EU, which mm-hmm. means you need to obtain it first. So you obtain it at an auction. So there's a price, there's an initial price for purchasing those allowances. And then what happens as the year goes on is if you have overpurchased and you're actually able to reduce your emissions throughout the year and you can predict that you're not going to need all of these allowances, you can trade them, which is great for the people who underestimated their emissions and realize that they mm-hmm. need more allowances and need to purchase them. So there'll be a market for the trading of allowances. The EU emission trading scheme has been up and running since, I think, 2005. So that aspect, that's tried and tested. That all works. And for shipping as well, there's a platform to work on here insofar as for the last couple of years, ships have been required to monitor and to report on the carbon dioxide emissions that they're producing. So the data yep. which informs the system is already being collected and shared. But what will change from the 1st of January next year is that someone needs to pay for that. And as you say, wherever there's a cost, then there's an incentive to reduce that cost. So the whole thrust of this is to reduce emissions in line with the EU's climate goals.
And this applies to ships arriving in the EU or leaving the EU or only when they're in EU waters? Or does it apply to the whole voyage? Or does it apply to them on an annual basis?
Oh, these are great questions. So at the moment, the scheme is intended to apply to all the scenarios that you just described. So ships arriving into the EU, ships leaving the EU and intra-EU voyages. But this is where there's a port of call. So these are voyages between ports where a substantial portion of cargo or passengers are loaded or unloaded. So if you're just, let's say you're sailing from South America and you're sailing into the EU, but you stop outside the EU in the UK just to refuel, that stop mm-hmm. won't count as a port of call. So the voyage, which will be counted for emissions purposes, will be from South America into the EU. Whereas if you stopped in the UK and discharged cargo and passengers, that would be the last port of call. And so you would count the UK to EU voyage for the purposes of emissions.
I was just going to say that's incredible because isn't the EU frightened, therefore, that that's going to turn the United Kingdom into a giant offshore entrepot?
Well, it will be interesting to see if that happens. I think for most trade, the trade exists along the lines it does for other reasons, and it's unlikely to be disrupted from those. There are perhaps a few scenarios where you could see there might be a small advantage to organisations rejigging the order of their ports of call to take advantage of a close by import out of the EU. My prediction is that for the most part, that's not really going to happen. But this is an area where we might see some change, because when aviation was incorporated into the emission trading scheme, initially it was on an all flights basis, and then that was later mm-hmm. narrowed to just be intra-EU. So it'll be interesting to see whether the final legislative changes allow for just intra-EU voyages to be counted, or whether they have this full international reach. Mm.
And I wonder, given the price of carbon permits in the EU is currently around 49 euros, mm-hmm. and it's risen from about 40 euros at the start of this year, I've seen some predictions that by the end of 2022, once shipping joins, that those carbon permits could be $80 to $100 per tonne of CO2.
Okay.
And a ship... burning one tonne of VLSFO will emit about 3.1 tonnes of carbon dioxide. And if you're burning 50 tonnes a day, that's 150 tonnes of carbon dioxide multiplied by 50 euros a tonne. You know, the prices get quite big.
Yeah.
So I guess that might be one of the reasons why we're seeing a big increase in the number of dual fuel vessels being ordered already, because people are ordering ships to be in that carbon priced trade in the future. So
yeah, and emissions trading is not limited to the EU. Shipping isn't included at the moment, but China launched its scheme in February of this year. The US is working on a scheme which also models the EU scheme. So we can see in the future that it won't just be voyages into and out of the EU where there'll be a price on emissions produced by ships. It's likely to be an increasingly global picture.
Yeah, we ran a survey among ship.energy readers of my other blog, Macro Macchiato, mm-hmm. which invited people to contribute to a survey about their opinions about what will happen with containerization and decarbonization.
What did they say?
45% of our readers were strongly supportive of an IMO emissions system, mm-hmm. and another 30% were somewhat supportive of an IMO emissions system in order to try and universalize a level playing field, this rather than having regional systems. So like you said earlier in the conversation, if we're going to have regulations, then let's have them apply to everybody. Let's have that level playing field.
Yeah, I think that's that would be very welcome, and I think that's the optimum in a way. The EU's position, it has been that it isn't going to wait and sort of be held back in its ambition and in the exercise of its ambition, you know, whilst waiting for the IMO. But it has set up its scheme in such a way that it can dovetail with what the IMO may do in the future, so that there can be global cohesiveness. I think something to kind of flush out here, though, when we're talking about the IMO is, you know, we talk about it as the IMO, as if it's a sort of autonomous regulator, which is sometimes criticized for dragging its heels and moving a bit slowly. An important thing to remember is that the IMO is a collection of 174 member states. And the reason that it sometimes isn't able to act as swiftly as smaller collections like the EU or individual nations mm-hmm. like the UK is that that's an awful lot of people to try and achieve a consensus between. So where parties and influencers have some sort of grievance with the fact that things at IMO level are not happening swiftly enough, it's important, I think, to remember that that's a political situation, and that the way to drive that and to accelerate that is by way of political mandate at national level, so that all of the member states are orientated in the same direction and are pushing mm-hmm. For that global uniformity, which I think the industry would welcome, and I think politically that would be welcomed as well globally.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think the IMO is subject to the electoral cycle of some of its members. Mm. Which can, you know, change national policy and national willingness to drive ahead IMO agendas.
Yeah.
So yeah, it can only move as quickly as the slowest of its large members anyway.
It has a tough job for sure.
Let's not get stuck in the IMO. I want to come back to regulations. You know, the commercial shipping industry runs off charter parties, and lawyers help fix and write charter parties, and you know there are an awful lot of them about. What do you think? Or how do you think perhaps clauses in charter parties are going to have to adapt to all these changing regulations and to the variety perhaps of low and zero carbon fuels that are now entering the market? You know, there are clauses that cover all these.
Yeah.
There are bunker clauses and so on. How are we going to have to change the way we manage the documentation?
Well, there's quite a lot of new technologies, new risks, new practices that will come onto the landscape. So there's definitely going to be some changes. You mentioned low and zero carbon fuels. We've got issues there around training and safety, different ways of carriage on board. There'll be retrofitting of new equipments probably onto older vessels. So that opens up scope for warranties and indemnities in relation to the operation of that equipment. We've discussed just-in-time arrivals, and that has an impact on things like the obligation of utmost dispatch and also the demurrage regime. We've touched already on new data and information sharing. That's quite an emerging theme, and that's such a greater collaboration between the parties in relation to the EU ETS. We can expect to see conditions and warranties to maintain allowances. There'll be issues there. And I think we'll see performance clauses change in nature, so that they'll probably include emissions criteria, and we can expect that they'll be orientated towards an optimum emissions performance. So some of the landscape, which I think in the past has been quite divided as sort of owners, charterers, and there's been more kind of push and pull between those two entities. My expectation is that we'll see increasingly, although ultimately, you know, risk tends to fall in one pot or the other, but in terms of dealing with all of these changes, I think we'll see more collaboration between the parties, and that will equally necessitate changes in charter parties, and that will be set out in charter party clauses. But I think some of the flavour of that process and of the way that the charter party functions may change a little bit.
Interesting. So one of the other benefits of shipping's path to decarbonisation could be owners and charterers working in ever closer harmony.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think if we were to rewind some time, we would maybe see a more divided perspective on whose issue this was to deal with. And I think a little bit further back in the whole kind of green shipping discussion, people would have maybe anticipated this is more of an owner's issue to deal with. This is about ships being green. But what we're really seeing, and I think we've seen it tremendously in the last kind of 18 months, 2 years, is all stakeholders kind of stepping up to take responsibility and to be driven as well to play a role in this. So in relation to charters, for instance, we've seen a Sea Cargo Charter. Charterers themselves are also coming under pressure from their financiers, and we've got the Poseidon Principles. That's an independent industry initiative from the finance sector. So I think the picture has changed a little bit, and there's a much wider acceptance of the notion that everybody will be playing a role, and so it's not just being kind of pushed off to one particular segment of stakeholders to deal with. This is much more of a multi-stakeholder environment now.
Yeah, I think for sure we've moved past lots of statements about we're all going to have to work together on this to the stage
how?
Where we are
all
now working together on this. So that's good.
Absolutely.
Well, Rachel Hoyland, thank you so much for joining us. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I really appreciate you coming on to share those insights and perspectives with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Do listeners have a look around the Ship Energy website, because a number of the issues that Rachel and I have been discussing are covered in various articles on the website. So have a look at those. But we will speak to you again soon, and look out for the next edition of the Ship Energy podcast. Thanks again to our guest, Rachel Hoyland, and goodbye.